Okay, I promise I will be very brief. For two reasons. The first is that what I really wanted to say, David has already said it in a way I cannot match. The second is that I feel there is some impatience in the room. And a number of you probably would like to have a discussion rather than a lecture. So if the remarks I'm going to make are patchy, it will be for these reasons. So the initial thought was to share with you a set of really broad observations on the violence of borders in our world today. David did a fantastic job in that sense, and Tai also in the reading she offered. I will just like to add a few minor points to what they already said. But while preparing for the presentation, I also quickly realized that there's no way we can examine the violence of borders without critically reassessing in the same process what I should call the new frontiers of violence in our world today, the ways in which the nature and the qualities, intrinsic qualities of violence have been mutating. And to that extent, I think David and Tai also did a great job in introducing us to this. So in terms of telegraphic remarks, I think it is absolutely possible to argue that the government of human mobility might be the most important problem to confront the world during the first half of the 21st century. I don't know about the second half of the 21st century, but clearly during the first half, this might well become the most important dilemma our world has to deal with. It has to deal with this while it is pretty clear that what W.E.B. Du Bois called the problem of the 20th century, that of the color line, which David also spoke about, has not been resolved. It has not been resolved in America, where democracy for a long time has gone hand in hand with slavery. It has not been resolved in Europe. If anything, Europe is only now waking up to that dilemma. Nor has it been resolved in South Africa, where we might probably have, for the first time in the history of modern humankind, we have for maybe a unique opportunity to finally reconcile the questions of the color line and the question of freedom and emancipation at large. So the question of the government of human mobility will be the most important problem we have to confront for all kinds of reasons. One is that worldwide, the combination of fast capitalism and the saturation of the everyday by digital and computational technologies have led to the acceleration of speed and the intensification of connections. So in this regard, we can well argue that our era is one of planetary entanglement. Yet, wherever we look, and this was very clear in the first two presentations tonight, the drive is also quite decisively towards something we might call enclosure. I would like to suggest that paradigmatic of this new matrix of rule, the drive to enclosure is in fact an attempt at manufacturing a new matrix of rule, paradigmatic of which I would say is Gaza. And Gaza came up in David's presentation too. Gaza, because here we have an instance in which spatial violence, humanitarian strategies, and I would say peculiar biopolitics of punishment, all of these combine to produce in turn a peculiar carceral space where borders and tunnels, disengagement turned blockade, intermittent closures, periodic shellings, and a state of siege constantly interface. It seems to me that we are not that far when we look into the logic that is at work in Gaza. We can easily make the formulate the hypothesis that in large swathes of our world, when we look at them, a process of becoming Gaza of the world is in the making. That what's going on in Gaza has a chance to be reproduced in many different ways in other parts of our, that's part of what the future might hold for us. I mentioned Gaza because it's also a clear-cut case of something we could call the normalization of abandonment. The normalization of abandonment is also a new manner in which the production and the manufacturing of violence is operating in the world right now. Abandonment here means one or two things. It refers to cases where the dominant power practically abdicates governance. It abdicates direct administration. It's not interested in that. It abdicates any responsibility for the lives and the welfare of a specific population group. And yet, abandonment does not signify an end to domination. It rather has to do with the emergence of apparatuses whose function, I think, is to ensure a systematic withdrawal of care and renunciation of obligations towards a designated population. In the case of Gaza, but as I suggested, other parts of the world, the normalization of abandonment is not only part of the of contemporary modalities of violence, it is also a political mechanism, a military mechanism for the administration of human biological life itself, in the sense that the body and living conditions of any individual belonging to the said population group may be hurt, may be damaged, may be destroyed, may be taken away, without this changing anything in the state's modus operandi. In the sense that people's suffering is not interpreted as urgent, or in any case urgent enough to prompt action. As David was saying, such people don't belong, therefore why should we care? That's what I mean by the becoming Gaza of large sections of the world. So that's the second telegraphic remark. But let me make another set of telegraphic remarks which have to do with the fact that, to a large extent, the capacity to decide who can move and who can settle where and under what conditions might well be at the core of the political struggles of our times. Might well be that moment when existing societies have to face the kinds of différends that are somewhat unresolvable. And therefore, because they are somewhat unresolvable, the likelihood of a descent into what David was calling a civil war, that likelihood becomes even more manifest. That if contemporary societies are to descend into civil war today, one of the reasons will be their inability to come to terms to some agreement about who belongs and who doesn't. I say this because the right of non-citizens to cross national borders and enter a host country may not have been formally abolished, at least yet. But as evidenced by countless ongoing events, it is becoming increasingly procedural, and it can be suspended or revoked at any time and under any pretext. Anna Arendt spoke about all of this not so long ago. I don't mean that it is happening again exactly in the same terms, but clearly this is something one has to take seriously. Of course, all of this does not apply to everybody in equal measure. Obviously, it hits some more than others, and this in itself merits specific and detailed studies. But clearly, part of what is going on is a reconfiguration of figures, modes of belonging, at the heart of which is, seems to me, the figure of the migrant, or what we might call migrant existence, an existence that is inflected with uncertainty and instability, a condition which is itself, to some extent, a consequence of neoliberal globalization, and I would add related transformations in the world of work and the new grammars of exploitation. And here, I think it is important to put forward the idea that the new migrant condition has to be examined in relation to the emerging carceral landscapes of our world. The idea here is, if you wish, is that if you are a migrant, you are very likely to end up in one form or another of a prison. That to be detained, to be confined and deported is part of the options you face. The facts in here are pretty overwhelming. I'm sure that you all know them. Suffice it to say that we have witnessed a significant expansion of landscapes of detention over the last decade, and the growth of detention structures, most of them along transnational routes traveled by migrants, such is the case, for instance, through Northern Africa, Northern Europe, Indonesia, Central America. And simultaneously, detention and deportation have become more than ever interlocking industries. I could give you the figures, they count in billions of dollars. So it's not simply, it's an economy. It's supported by a booming economy. The types of vulnerability that are legally produced are not simply a legal matter. They are also an economic matter, and it's more than time for us to look seriously into the economic system that keeps feeding off these biopolitical practices in relation to migrancy, but also, as it has been shown in the case of the US, in relation to incarceration, or what Gilmore calls the prison industrial complex. So, just to end with this set of remarks, then I'll give you two more and then we can debate. It's very clear, I mean, listening to Tai and David, it's very clear that a redeployment of sovereignty and of state power, for that matter, is underway with a global expansion of security in infrastructure, ranging from David mentioned walls to the deployment of new killing machines, military hardware to monitor and secure space. So renewed investment, political, military, and affective investment in border work, which itself has required the institution of various assemblages, we can call border assemblages, of multiple actors, some of them public, most of them private. So the suggestion is that in order to have a grasp on the new qualities of violence, in this world of ours, which is characterized by what are called planetary entanglement, we have to pay close attention to the novel political geography that is emerging, which requires, seems to require at least, a non-linear understanding of territory. In the sense that in this new geography, old demarcations such as inside and outside, such as land and sea, land and air, those demarcations hardly obtain any longer. If only because the inside can now be outside, the sea on land and the land on sea, and what we used to take as close can be far away, and vice versa. So the old models of sovereignty, which were based on the actual physical control of discrete territories, to these old models, contemporary states are grafting a new model of mobile and, if you wish, itinerant sovereignty. And And this is achieved through dislocating linear border functions, pushing them both outward in other states' territories and inward into national societies, this externalization requiring a degree of outsourcing. I won't go into the technologies of classification that this rescaling of territory and borders requires. Let me just insist on the fact of border control becoming more individualized, more molecular, as digitization allows surveillance to zero in on the smaller spaces, such as the body, and continuously monitor them. The point I really want to make, and then I'll move to the last two remarks, is the extent to which contemporary border security practices have taken a keen interest in the connection between the human body and identity as a means of achieving detailed control over the territoriality of movement. So the question, since I know you are impatient to debate, the question I will put to you before you put it to us is why is it important for states that the governing of mobility be extended into domains that regulate almost every aspect of daily life? What is at stake in the extension of the biometric border into the multiple realms of the human body? Why this return to not on the human body at large, but the mobile body? Why this return to the body and the mobile body if the goal is not to turn all of us into portable borders? Let me then end with two comments on the borders of violence. The first set of comments had to do with the violence of borders. Now I want to make two comments on the borders of violence, meaning the extent to which we have witnessed a qualitative transformation of violence as such. Here I think that, and David in particular spoke at length about it, the borders of violence have extended. They have also been extended. They have expanded as a result of progress in military technologies. And we know the extent to which such new technologies, most of them are invented in military laboratories before they are they expand into civilian life. I think progress in military technologies has happened at a pace that challenges human cognitive and even reasoning capacities. Some of these technologies have an ostensible capacity to pinpoint targets with great precision. And here I'm relying a lot on the work of Grégoire Chamaillou and his philosophy of the drone, a work which indicates, with the work of many others, that what we are facing nowadays are new machines of death. New machines of death, which are characterized to a large extent by the entwinement of algorithmic knowledge and biological knowledge. All of that, of course, propelled by the accelerated drive towards automated and autonomous technologies that aid or supersede the human in the process of killing. New killing machines that to kill has become absolutely central to any understanding. It's not simply about to let die, but to actually organize culture, society, technology, to organize oneself with the goal of killing. Whole point studied by the likes of Canetti, Jung and the others, this has become central to any attempt at making sense of our present. Just look at the number of kill and watch lists, because the two go together, which is, as we know, is constantly growing and playing an ever more crucial role in the politics of targeted killing. In fact, as I speak, almost every state is generating its watch and kill lists. And imagine what it would be. I mean, look, I wake up in the morning and then I look at the list of my enemies, and then I decide, okay, oh, today, let me take the life of this one. So the question many of these powers are facing is, how is it that we harmonize different watch and kill lists, all of which requires, of course, the deployment of various devices whose aim is to profile suspects or targets based on human intelligence. So the politics of intelligence production and targeted killing requires more and more devices for data mining and analytics. So that's the first observation I wanted to make. I could go on this. I just refer you to the works of the likes of Shamayo. All of this, and I will end there, raises all kinds of ethical questions. It raises all kinds of ethical questions. These, for instance, what is the regime of political violence that is produced through the use of these apparently virtuous and virtuous technologies? Because you do have a number of people who are arguing today that it's better to kill with a drone than via decapitation. I mean, is there really a difference between killing with a drone and decapitation? So this question of the conflation of functionality, legality, and effectiveness, conflation of all of that with morality, raises all kinds of fundamental issues in terms of our way of thinking about war and the ethics of war in an age in which enmity seems to have become the sacrament of our times. So I will leave you with those difficult questions. And I thank you very much for inviting me here.